So let's pivot a little bit into your concert music career, which is significant. And, you know, just to kind of go back to how we met, the first thing I had heard of yours written for eight horns, because the gig was eight horns at the time, was Euphonies. And this is a piece written for horn octet that, you know, just to kind of bring up the name Brian O'Connor again, who was a great horn player for many, many years here in town and was a protege of Vince DeRosa, a name that you mentioned, you know, the kind of the magic god at all things French horn, Vince. So let's talk a bit about your concert music. I bring up Euphonies. It's a really, really cool horn octet. For those out there listening to this that haven't heard it, go listen to it. It's super, super cool. You mentioned your tuba concerto, which gets a lot of play by orchestras around the world. One of my favorite pieces of yours, and you know, I'd love for you to just kind of talk a bit about some of the things I'm mentioning, but you know, we can converse however you want, is the piece you wrote for the Bay Brass. Yeah, the Marches, Fanfare, Hymns, and Finale.
Fanfare's Marches, Hymns, and Finale. Yeah.
That's got some really hip harmony, man. I mean, really hip harmony. And just to touch on that point, since we're kind of in concert mode, and I hope that we can kind of talk back and forth a little bit about this. You are obviously very much a harmony guy. And I remember you saying this to me years ago when we first met, you know, it's like, look, if you're going to study anything, go study harmony, which is not too far away from what Jerry used to say to me. And, you know, form is obviously, one of the elephants in the room, particularly in film. But your sound, your voice, your musical DNA has such a unique sound. It's easily identifiable. And there's a wonderful blend of diatonicism and chromaticism. And your knowledge of early music is substantial, to say the least. So, I mean, that's super hip harmonies, man, you know, that piece for the Bay Brass. So let's talk a little bit about concert music, your concert music in general. I'll never forget you saying to me years ago, if I'm ever going to teach, when I say this is you saying it to me, if I'm ever going to have to teach another orchestration course, I'm going to start with Tchaikovsky. That's who you should start with, which I think is illuminating that's where your brain went then. I'm not sure if you feel the same now, but I love to pick your brain because the bedrock of music is built with, you know, those tenets, harmony, rhythm, form, and whether or not you have that gift to write for film and television, which clearly you do, it doesn't matter if you don't know how to write music. So here we are in the purism of music. Let's chat.
Film music is, and this isn't denigrating, film music is accompaniment. It's kind of like listening to the Schubert Ave Maria without somebody singing it, just hearing all those arpeggios.
Sure.
Because the voice is actually the picture. And I remember this from Earl Hagen years ago, who I learned a ton of stuff from. Earl would say, when you're putting music to a film, sometimes you're required to put a lot of music into it because the drama needs it, you know? Sometimes maybe you put as much as 60, 70, 80% in it. Sometimes you only need 5%. So when it's 5%, you don't want to give it 6%. You know, it's one of those things. And I found over the years that that's really true. In fact, Jerry, since we were speaking about him, was always, to my mind, incredible at giving the picture just what it needed and never showing off, even though his technique was incredible. He wasn't showing off. He would just give the film what it needed and then to let the film play by itself. You know? With concert music, you are the voice and you are the accompaniment. And you have to hold an audience and the player's interest from the beginning to the end of it. And that, to me, is a very different requirement. I've done a lot of teaching in the last few years, and I found that the basic stuff is not really, I'm not really impressed a lot with what young people learn basically. And I'm surprised when I ask them the kinds of courses they got in school when they were going through graduate, through their bachelor degree. I mean, some of the composers don't get courses in composition. They get rudimentary harmony, but they don't know how to work it. Mm. They can't write tunes. And if they wrote a tune, they couldn't harmonize it. And if they could harmonize it, they couldn't arrange it. So, I mean, it's like, what kind of an education is that? I will say in their defense, that a lot of what I learned came about. I had an okay education, but a lot of it came by the experience of working in television, where television was a very fast medium, and you know, I was popping out 2 or 3 shows a week, doing it by myself, not with help. And I always did my own orchestration because I wanted to hear my improvement and my mistakes, you know, and correct them my way. So a lot of that was just working. And it's like, if you're going to be a great pianist, you better practice a lot. And if you're going to be a great composer, not that I'm a great composer, but if you're going to be a good composer, a solid composer, you need to practice a lot. So that's what I do. So concert music, years ago, when I was still immersed in television before I got into features, the great thing about television was that you had the summer off because nobody did anything during the summer. So that's when I would write pieces. People would ask me, would you write a piece for me? Or I've got a group. Can you write this? You know what I mean? So I would be writing this all the time. The biggest difference I found between concert music and film music was this thing that you went by really quickly, form. Mm-hmm. When you're working in a movie, you don't ever have to think about form. The movie tells you what to do. The movie tells you where to go. The movie tells you how long the phrase is going to be. You better learn about transitions, because just when you think that you're going to get into that B section, there is no B section. You're transitioning back to the X section, you know, something like that.
Right.
So there's a ton of stuff that you learn in the movies that works really well when you're doing concert music. And in concert music, when you're struggling with these techniques of counterpoint and harmony and melodic construction and form and all that stuff, this helps you when you work in the movies. So it's looking back on it, I mean, it's incredible what you can do with a movie if you have enough technique. It's incredible what you can do with a performance. Somebody sheds a tear or looks like they're going to shed a tear. Somebody looks like they're going to laugh. I mean, there are these tiny movements that are now 35 feet tall because you're looking at a movie that you can move around, you know, with the music if you're so inclined. So when you put that into concert music, you really want to give all of this to the audience. The brass piece came about, I know several of the guys up in the San Francisco Symphony, and the Bay Brass is a group made up of players from the San Francisco Symphony and I think the San Francisco Opera, a couple of groups. It's a terrific group.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they're film music nerds. So that's how they got hold of me. So they said, would you be interested in writing a piece for us? I said, yeah. Again, they didn't know that I had a brass background. I mean, I have a huge brass background.
Yeah.
And so they told me what they wanted. They wanted this piece, multi-movement and blah, 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 blah. And then they said one other thing. They said, we really like your score to Tombstone. And I said, oh, so you like the big over-the-top kind of feeling? Yeah. I said, oh, okay. So in a sense, the ceiling came down because I was now... I don't mean that in any negative way, but I mean, if there's a positive way of saying it, what I meant was I suddenly had the form that I was going to write in, just like in a movie. You can't do everything you want to do in a movie. The movie doesn't permit it. I mean, you got to do that and you can't do that, you know? So here I knew basically the kind of piece that I was going to write. a couple of years later, I got a call from the Chicago Symphony when they have the Midwest Clinic in December.
Yeah.
Usually the Chicago Symphony Brass puts on a big concert.
Yeah, yeah,
it's really worth going to because the guys are great, you know. So they said, do you want to come and conduct your piece, you know, the Bay Brass piece? I said, yeah, sure, you bet. You're kidding. So I did that. And I did it the way I did it. Then they played it again a couple of years later, but I wasn't conducting. One of the guys was conducting. And they played it like twice as fast. I swear to the Lord, I thought they were going to lose it because they were like skidding around the corners. You know, they played everything just great. And I thought, oh, that's the way they want to play. You know, it's right. Really great. Silverado gets played pretty much the way that the movie is because that's the way it goes. And in the movie, that's the way it's supposed to be, you know. So, but when you've got a concert piece, you just don't know. I've had my butt saved a couple of times by conductors who knew what to do with the piece better than I did. You know, when the piece was looking like it's not going to do anything at all, a really fine conductor knows exactly what to do. And suddenly you've got this great piece and you've got this wonderful performance. I mean, it's really exciting. You know, I like working in different styles sometimes. I like working with different combinations. Right now I'm working on a piece for strings. I've done lots of band pieces. I finished, as I mentioned earlier, the piece for harp and flute. It's a concerto with orchestra. Mm-hmm. I find it fascinating. And now when I realize that I don't have to write for a director or I don't have to write for a studio or I don't have to write for something on demand, I get to do what I want.
Yeah.
I'm starting to dig deeper. I'm starting to actually feeling like a real composer for the first time in all these years. You know, I'm starting to feel like I can do that. If I don't like it, I'm going to erase it and I'm going to do it over again. If I have to sit there and figure out for 4 days how that phrase goes, I'm going to spend 4 days on that phrase. Can't do that in a movie, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there's a lot of truth in that. This was fairly recently, I believe, where you've now given up some of your music and your library to University of North Texas. Is that right?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. How did that come to be? That's great. I mean, you got to archive this stuff somehow, and that's a hip university. You know, the last time I went out there, it's been years, but I asked the guys, I said, look, I'm happy to come out and do a master class and blah, blah, blah. We'll record what we recorded. But I said to them, I need to be able to build in a time to my schedule every day I'm out there to go listen to the 1 o'clock jazz band. Otherwise, I'm not coming, you know? So they got a great tradition of musicality out there. So share a little bit about the UNT connection.
Well, I knew the dean. The dean actually was a friend of my brother's and met years ago. And he was the dean at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln when I first came into contact with him. So he asked me if I'd come out and I'd do a residency in Nebraska, which I said I would. Then he got the job at UNT, mm-hmm. University of North Texas, which is one heck of a music school. I've got to tell you, I mean, that is one heck of a music school. So he asked me if I'd be interested in coming out. Well, he had some plans for me, and that's sort of typical of him. But I just came out, and I didn't know that I really wanted to be so involved in the university thing. So I got there, and I had a meeting. I got a tour of the facilities, which were to me very impressive. And then I had a meeting with the music faculty, basically the composition faculty and the film music people. The film part of the film school. They don't have a film school, but they have a film department. Okay.
Right.
And I had never met this guy before. He was the chairman of the film studies thing. He was a director and really a nice guy, really personable guy. And what I didn't know was, he didn't know anybody sitting around the table who I was meeting for the first time. They're all talking about the possibility of a program of putting music and film together. You know, I mean, like, you know, like USC has and all this
right.
stuff, like NYU has and Berkeley and all this stuff. They were talking about it. But the difference was they were all talking about what the students could get out of it, what the film students could get out of it, what the music students could get out of it. And there was this camaraderie. And I'm saying, this is a new guy. The film guy's a new guy, you know?
Yeah.
Usually he's the interloper, not this guy. Eugene Martin, that's his name. He's a great guy. And I thought, and I'm looking at the faculty and I'm thinking, wow, this is really cool. This is a really cool setup. So John Richmond, the dean, said, I'd like you to do a residency here, be our composer in residence. And he said, what I'm suggesting is you come out here for 4 weeks a year, two in one semester, two in the next semester, and spend a week here with our students. Mm-hmm. We're working on film stuff. We'll work on composition. And we'll see if we can build this together. So that was the first thing I did. I started working with Eugene and the film people, and I started to talk to his directors and to his teachers and to their classes. And we were just starting this. Well, then I think the next year they hired a guy who I think you know, Drew Schnur. Do you know Drew?
I know the name. I don't know Drew, but I know the name.
So they hired Drew to really get behind this full time. Drew's from UCLA. He's a composer. He's done some film work, you know, so he's knowledgeable about it. He's a great teacher. I mean, he's he's a great guy. I like him a lot. The people at UNT, the faculty, I really like them a lot. It's like a big family. They're really terrific, but they're also really knowledgeable. So here's Drew, who's a great organizer. Drew is a great teacher. I've seen him in class. I've seen him break down film scores and film music and all this other kind of stuff. I mean, he's just tremendous. So I go out there and do my residencies. I talk to students. I give composition lessons. I give talks to, I sit in on classes. I give my opinion when I'm asked for it. I'm still involved in it, but I think it's evolving into a school that's going to have it's going to be one of the places you're going to want to go to study film music, you know, because it's a great place to go to study, God knows, jazz. I mean, the 1 o'clock band is great. The 2 o'clock band is pretty great. You know, the 3 o'clock band is not bad, you know? So that was, and I've always enjoyed teaching. I did a lot of teaching at USC. I did a lot of teaching at UCLA. Mm-hmm. I like it. I like seeing what people are doing. You know, here's the interesting thing about it. You meet students who obviously are not ever going to become great composers, but they're interested in it and they bring you a piece. And then you find other people who obviously are talented and they bring you a piece and you look at it and you're trying to figure out, why is that note there? I don't understand that note, but there's some reason that person put it there. And you have to figure out what the reason is, you know?
Yeah.
And all these notes, if you look at this piece that looks like a plumber put it together, you know, you look at it and you go, no, this actually represents something for this person. There's a lot of feeling invested in this and there's, you know, some technique invested. So you have to figure out not what it means to me, what does it mean to them? Yeah. And how can you get them to write better so that they become more fulfilled and their audiences and their players become more fulfilled? You know, it's a really great thing to be able to do. And the best thing you can possibly get told is, one guy told me this one time, he said, you know, you're the only guy who understands what my music's about. I took that as being a really big compliment, you know, because you can see he's struggling with certain things and he's got a real voice that he wants to get out there and you got to help these guys along, you know?
Yeah.
It's really cool. I mean, somehow all the years I worked in the movies, trying to figure out what the movies were about, trying to figure out what people wanted, trying to figure out what a director was saying. Some of them are very clear. Some of them are not very clear. Some of them are really nervous. Some of them are very pugnacious. They're just people, right?
Yeah.
But in that job, you've got to get it done so that somebody says, thank you, that's what I wanted, or go away because you're done. I mean, whatever the end result is, knowing that you've contributed something. And when you get one-on-one teaching or one-on-one performing, you know, when somebody plays a piece of yours and they like it, and then the audience likes it, or when you get a standing ovation. One time I did a piece, we were at a summer festival in Kansas. And I was conducting they let me conduct the concert. They had a chamber orchestra. I conducted the concert and I wrote a piece for it. I had to conduct real pieces. Okay, I'm an okay conductor, but one of the pieces I had to conduct was the Barber Violin Concerto. I don't ever want to do that again because that piece was really hard, but we got it done. Okay, so then I do my piece at the end. I don't know what it was. I mean, it was, you know, I'm trying to get my piece done. It was a really good orchestra. And after it was over, people started to applaud. And I turned around and I saw a wave in the crowd, you know, that when people are standing up like this, but it started from the back row. It wasn't people looking at people from the front. It started from the back row. People started to get up and the back row stood up and then the row behind in front of them stood up. And then the wave was backwards, but it was like the best way because it was like, oh, they like it. You know, it went off well. I mean, you know how thrilling that is? Nobody does that in the movies. you know, the director doesn't tell you, oh, I love the voicings. That's really great. You know, it's, they just say, okay, that's great. Let's go to the next piece. Yeah. But here, you can actually see it. You can actually feel it. You know, it's,
yeah.
I'm a really lucky guy. I mean, I'm really a lucky guy because I'm still able to do this and I mean, it's really great. I mean, it's really, really great life.
You're right about the shared experience, you know, being able to kind of ingest and then digest, you know, music in a live space, and whether or not it was intended for the concert stage or intended for film, and now being shared so much more often in the live space, not the least of which are some of these, you know, live to film projects. But this shared experience, the live shared experience, can never be replicated. And, you know, given what we're all kind of dealing with COVID, I know that it will come back in full force at some point for that reason, if not, you know, any other, is that you cannot replicate that shared experience. And we know
you know this one really well because you do a lot of film conducting and you go from orchestra, town to town, country to country, and you get to experience the audience experiencing the film, of course, but they're experiencing the music the way they couldn't do in the film.
Right.
I've had one experience. We had Silverado done live with the Chicago
Symphony. Chicago. Yeah.
And it was really interesting because as I was watching the film, for one thing, the music sounded great. There were no sound effects to get in the way. And they put they put the dialogue up on the screen so you can see it, even if you can't hear it. But the thing that I realized was about halfway through, most of the audience had never seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. They were actually, because they were laughing at the jokes the first time, you know, and they're reacting to this whole thing. And I thought, wow, this is really interesting. They're really feeling the music, but they're really feeling the movie. I mean, they're getting the whole thing, you know. That was really interesting, really cool. I mean, but you do this, you know, you do this all the time and see it with a lot of different composers, a lot of different films.
Yeah, it's a very unique space, and it's a lot of fun. You know, it comes with a lot of challenges, but ultimately a lot of fun. Let's pivot back to a little bit of animation, and we'll pause here for a minute and play the main tune from Tiny Toon Adventures.
We're tiny, we're toony,
we're all a little loony,
and in this cartoony, we're invading your TV.
With comic dispensers,
we crack up all the sensors.
On Tiny Toon Adventures, get a dose of comedy.
So here's at the Acres, it's a whole wide world apart.
Our home sweet home stands alone, a cartoon work of art.
The scripts were rejected, expect the unexpected.
On Tiny Toon Adventures, it's about to start.
They're furry, they're funny,
they're Bass and Buster.
Montana Max has money,
Elmira is a pain.
He's hunting and plucky,
Dizzy Devil yucky.
Curveball's unlucky,
and Go-Go is insane.
And at the university, we earn our Toon degree.
The teaching staff been getting laughs since 1933.
We're tiny, we're toony,
we're all a little loony.
It's Tiny Toon Adventures, come and join the fun.
And now our song is done.
Now you were on, like 3 years? Contributing in some way, or did they use your theme in a really big way in Animaniacs, the theme that you wrote for Tiny Toon?
I got the job from Doug Frank.
Doug, man, he's not there anymore.
He was head of music there, and he had this new cartoon show, which is a television thing, that was co-produced by Steven Spielberg and Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
And the gag in it was they were going to use all the old Warner Brothers characters but treat them as children. So there was a Bugs Bunny, but there was just little Bugs and Buster. His name was Buster, and then Babs was the girl. And you know they had all the characters like this. So he needed somebody to write the theme. He needed somebody to supervise the composition. You'd prefer to have a composer in charge. And he needed somebody who had some history with Steven Spielberg. So that it would go smoothly. Okay. Yeah. So I'd had some history with Steven. I'd done 2 or 3 of his movies that he produced. And so I wrote the theme and I did, my job was to hire to write as many of these shows as I could and then hire the composers to do the rest of them. We started with something like 65 episodes to do, and we ended up with 100 episodes. One of the guys who I hired was Richard Stone. Now my system of hiring people, I think I offended a lot of friends, which is unfortunate, but I would listen to everything. I mean, I listened to every solicitation I got from, it didn't matter who it was from. Agents contacted me. I learned a lot about agents, you know. They would say, contact me by throwing a bunch of stuff together in a paper bag and say, here, if you hear something you like, let us know, you know. But I listened to everything. I listened to everything. And I listened to a lot of people who had a lot of, you know, ability and that kind of stuff. But I, unless I got the sense that they could actually write this kind of music, because it had to be in the style of Carl Stalling as much as possible.
Yeah.
Unless I got that, I couldn't hire them. So I know I ticked a lot of people off, which is too bad. So so I had like seven or eight composers to work with, and then I ran out of composers. And I got a tape from a mutual friend of Richard Stone's. Now, Richard was a music editor. He wanted to be a composer, and he loved working on cartoons. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any of this stuff. And he had ingested Carl Stalling and his style. And I didn't know any of this stuff. So I get a tape of Richard's. Well, he was doing some sort of reality show, and the music was just not the right type. But it wasn't so far away that I could tell for sure that he couldn't do it.
Right.
And it got down to that week when I had absolutely nobody else. So I called him and offered him a show, offered him an hour. And he says, oh, yeah, I'd love to do that. Okay, so I couldn't go to his recording, which was unfortunate, because for 2 weeks, I sweated bullets. I thought, man, if this guy doesn't come up with something reasonably good, you know, this is going to be a rough one. Because Steven Spielberg was actually the producer. I mean, he would call me up and he'd say, well, I just saw the show and I really liked the score and blah, blah, blah. And there were a couple that he didn't like, and I heard about those too. Mm-hmm. So the day of the recording, I called up my music editor, Patty Carlin, and she's there on the stage. And I said, how's it going? She says, fine. I said, no, really, Patty, how's it going? I mean, how's he doing? No, he's doing fine. I said, you don't understand. She said, Bruce, you don't have to worry. It's fine. Okay. It was so low key. It wasn't fine. It was tremendous, because this guy was like the reincarnation of Carl Stalling. I mean, he had the whole thing down. I mean, he was great. Richard went on to do a career with Warner Brothers. Every time we ran into each other, he'd say, oh, I can't thank you enough for doing this. This was my life. You know, I said, yeah, believe me, you did a good job. You helped me out.
Yeah.
He went on, he did Animaniacs. He became, they gave him a position at Warner Brothers, you know, and he was like a pig in shit. You know, I mean, he was just so happy to be doing this stuff. He hired other guys. He got the Bernsteins involved and Steve and Emily, you know, and he got a whole bunch of other people involved. It was great. I mean, it was just, again, it was just one great thing. I actually had Larry Rosenthal do an episode. He was great, you know. Yeah. I mean, he's an Academy Award guy, you know. I mean, he was great. Joel McNeely.
Debney did some things.
Yeah. I mean, we had some really big guys doing it, you know. Bill Ross. I mean, some of the scores were great. Some of the scores weren't so great, but of the ones that were good, I'm very proud. And it was really interesting. I could sit there and I could look at what the composers were doing. And I'm learning too. I'm saying, oh, that was cool how they did. Oh, Mort Stevens, the guy who wrote the Hawaii Five-O theme.
Yeah.
The guy who ran the department at CBS when I was working there, I hired him too. He was crazed. I mean, he was just great. You know, he was just great. So, yeah, it was a fun gig.
Well, before we pivot to one last film, for those out there listening that either do already know the theme from Tiny Toon Adventures or don't yet know it, from an analytical standpoint, go have a listen to what Bruce did there, because he very quickly, and this is where, yeah, to your point, technique comes in, very quickly he starts in E major, he ends up a major third up in A flat major, and then another major third up in C major, and within about 35 seconds he cycles through three very cool keys that makes it kind of help create this kind of cyclical fun thing. And so that's the technique harmonically behind it. And so I'd hope that some of our listeners go and kind of listen in that way, listening for that E to A flat to C.
You know why I did that?
Because let's hear it.
If you play the whole tune in the same key, it's really boring. And I mean, it truly is. I mean, it's a good tune in that it does all the stuff it's supposed to, but I remember I finished it and I sat there and I thought, okay, but it doesn't work. It does all the right things, but it doesn't work. And then I thought, oh, actually, I learned it from Carl Stalling.
Yeah.
If I throw that up a third, that's cool. Yeah. I got all this energy, you know. Yeah. So it worked.
Okay, so we'll come to this last one here from 1993, one of my favorite westerns, literally of all time, Tombstone, and not the least of which is the contributions from a musical standpoint helped to make this incredibly fresh, unique, dark movie. And obviously the movie is given to us in a very dark way. Anyway, as you pointed out earlier in the show, everyone's bad to some degree. But, you know, look, that stops to a point, and then it has to be picked up by the music and shared in a different kind of emotional way. So let's have a look at one of the great scenes, which there are many from the film. But this is kind of a culmination scene, so to speak. And it's certainly the culmination of so many things come together. This is the scene with Wyatt Earp and his immortals finally kind of going carte blanche and, you know, around the Western frontier and just shooting everybody and their brother with a red sash. So let's have a listen and a look to this one. But so about, you know, 50 seconds into the scene, that's the first time we kind of get the main tune, so to speak, in the horns. And I love that, you know, you get it in that modulated key in the trumpets after finally Ike lets his sash go down. This is a great scene, and it's great music. You know, I just now listening to this again, I also recall feeling the same way, not only in the movie theater, but every time I've seen it on DVD since. This is one of those rare films where the level of music and sound effect and dialogues are all really, really well balanced. And there's very few times in the movie from a music perspective where you feel like it's buried. I mean, it's there. It's a voice that is constantly present. And that's just a balance observation. But one of my favorite scores, and I know many of our listeners for a lot of reasons, but for me, it's just how dark you went with this and the orchestration, you know, the instruments of choice, you know, using the cymbalum and using these metallic instruments and going very, very low in the contrabassoon and things that you'd normally don't hear in a Western score, including your one from 1985 in Silverado. So let's hear your actions here. This remains a classic to this day.
First of all, before I forget, they were Tombstone and Silverado were mixed by the same guy, Rick Klein. And he's a fabulous mixer. And I owe a lot to him because both those scores sound really good, you know,
yeah,
when you listen to them in the theater. When I first went to see this, they only had the first half ready because they were dying to get this thing done for, you know, release. And they had it tracked, the Silverado. And it was awful. I mean, it was awful, and it made the movie look stupid. So we took a break, and George Cosmatos, the director, walked out, and he said, "So how do you like my music?" And I said, "Oh, I like your music a lot, George. I just don't like it in this film." Okay. So I can't remember whether I was spotting it or I think I was just taking a look at it. And so I went home, and I thought, oh, man, this is going to be a crappy film because it really looked dumb. And it wasn't until I got into it that I realized, and once Silverado left it, that I realized the problem with the Silverado into this film was that Silverado was a completely different idea. I mean, Silverado was, as I said before, good guys and bad guys, and the lines were really well drawn. Family, people you love and people who you protect, all that kind of stuff. This movie, these aren't good guys. These guys who move their family to Tombstone so they can make money. You know, they're dealing cards in a bar and they're cheating on their wives, and the wives are, you know, they're doing drugs. I mean, it's like, where did this come from? Yeah. And even the scene, you know, that you're showing, these guys are, you don't have a scene like that in Silverado. These guys are shooting guys point blank. There's a whole bunch of stuff in here where people are just, it's a very violent movie, you know?
Yeah.
And it's a very melodramatic movie. People are shouting. I mean, there's that thing where Kurt Russell, he's there with a shotgun, you know, shouting, "I'm coming for you. I'm coming for you." I mean, it's so over the top. Yeah. He stands out there in the rain and he's yelling in the rain and blah.
He's amazing in his film. He's really over the top,
but it's really entertaining. It's really entertaining. And I find this movie really a lot of fun to watch. So again, like in Silverado, I was unrestrained. I played some of the theme for the producers, not for the director. The director was difficult. George could be really difficult. He was a very sweet guy, but when he wasn't sweet, he could be really difficult. And so the producers, who I said, if they could have, they would have had Jerry. Jerry couldn't do it, so I did. So I played the theme. And that was about all that came out of it. I wrote the score, went to London and recorded the score. The Andy Vanya, the exec producer, came over and he attended the session and gave me his comments. And again, I mean, he was used to working with Jerry, so he was very nice with me. And I decided, this film is so dark, why am I gonna fight it? So I didn't use a contra bassoon. Actually, I used a contra sarrusophone, which is a much different kind of, it sounds sort of like a cow in heat, you know, or a flatulent cow. I mean, it's really low and it's got this wide, wide sound on it, which the French used to use instead of the contrabassoon. You know, it actually, I think it has a clearer pitch. I used a cembalo, I used contrabass trombones. I used all this dark stuff. And the music, frankly, it's over the top. I mean, I admit it, it's really melodramatic. It's just all out there, you know, just wham, just right in your face. And I thought, why not? That's the way this movie is. And it's so emotional. One of my favorite scenes in Tombstone, actually, although there are a lot of great scenes and wonderful lines, and Val Kilmer is spectacular in the thing, and he makes you just love the movie. But one of the best scenes for me is at the very end when Doc Holliday dies, he and Earp are together. Now, a lot of this movie, as fun as it is actually happened. A lot of stuff that happened in that scene with Doc Holliday, he actually said those things. And even his bare feet, looking at his bare feet, he expected to die with his boots on, and he expected to be shot down. He didn't expect to be dying in some sanitarium, which he actually did. That thing between the two friends, to me, is so moving.
Yeah.
Well, there's a big romance in the film between Wyatt Earp and the actress.
Josephine, yeah.
The real romance, and I mean in bromance, I guess, is between the two guys, because they are so tight with each other. And that, to me, was the most endearing scene, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you look at it and you say, okay, this, you can't make this stuff up. There it is. You got that to work with. So something that's going to support that. I mean, thank you. Thank you. Thank you, George. Thank you, whoever did this, you know, thank you. So I was, I like it because it's not Silverado. It's the only other Western I actually did. People think I did a lot of Westerns. I did a lot of Americana stuff, but I only did two Westerns.
Right.
Although in television I did Westerns, but for movies I only did Westerns. That was it. And again, I didn't do any rewrites. I didn't have any pushback when we got to the recording. The recording was great. Rick did a great job on the sound. It was just, you know, I saw something last night on a video about Tombstone, and I saw the clip, and then I started to read the comments. I sat there for 15 minutes as the comments kept going on, and they all said basically the same thing. This is the greatest movie. This is the best Western movie. Val Kilmer should have gotten an Oscar. This, yeah. you know, blah, blah, blah. And I finally went to bed because I don't know how long the comments keep going. They just keep yeah. going.
Yeah.
People like the movie. And I'm happy about that because I like the movie. I find it really entertaining.
It's a great one. Well, we all appreciate you sharing this kind of retrospective. And as you mentioned earlier, you don't spend a whole lot of time looking backward. And that's obvious because you're constantly creating new and looking forward. So thank you for all this time and helping us kind of share a little bit through your eyes and your memories, kind of where you are now and where you're going. And we're looking forward to whatever's coming up for you. So Bruce Broughton, thank you for being here on Film Music Focus.
Thank you, Justin. I just want to say it's been a real treat to talk to you. You know your stuff, you're prepared, and we know each other, but this has been really a lot of fun. I really appreciate you asking me to do this.
No, it's my pleasure. It's my pleasure, really. So thank you. And for all of you out there, we'll see you for the next Film Music Focus. Until then.
Brought to you by Santa Concerts.